way they pick TV shows is they make one show. That show's called a pilot. Then they show that one show to the people who pick shows. And on the strength of that one show, they decide if they want to make more shows. Some get chosen and become television programs. Some don't. Become nothing.
Hello and welcome to Drop the Pilot, the podcast dedicated to TV pilots that became nothing. I'm Jimmy Brown, and today I am joined by writer, producer, stand-up, and all-round nice guy, David Misch. Hello, David.
Well, one of those is wrong, but I won't press your hand at the moment.
This episode, we shall be talking about the 1987 pitch reel for the Jim Henson-directed Inner Tube, which runs at just under 10 minutes long, and was written by, David Misch.
Wow, what a coincidence. Yeah. And lucky I'm here.
So I'll just ask you straight away, David, how did you become involved with Inner Tube?
Well, let's see. I'm actually spacing now. Was that before or after The Muppets Take Manhattan?
After.
It was after. Thank you. Well, that's how.
87.
Oh, 87. That's right. I was thinking 82 for some reason. So anyway, I had done Muppets Take Manhattan with Frank Oz. And of course, Jim was part of that as well. Mm-hmm. And it all went well, and Jim asked me to work on this idea he had. Basically, he wanted to do two things. He wanted to get more of a presence on TV. The Muppet Show had ended a few years earlier. And second of all, he wanted to do something without the Muppets, without the traditional Muppets, especially Kermit. He really wanted to show that he could not be dependent on them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we put our heads together and came up with this, and after it was written, it was a conventional half-hour pilot, and Jim sent it to his manager, Bernie Brillstein, one of the most powerful managers in show business. He did not like it and wanted to just do a short version that was sort of reconfigured from what my original script had been. The basic premise, which was a guest star, in this case, I chose John Candy because I loved him, but he wasn't committed or anything. That was just who I thought would be fun.
Yeah.
John Candy gets lost in this huge cable system of hundreds and hundreds of channels, which, of course, didn't exist then and existed later. So I'm incredibly prescient. And he gets lost there and bumps into all these unusual characters. And the big fun part was going to be he would just appear on different channels. At one point, he appears as a cold weather system on the Weather Channel. And by the way, the Weather Channel didn't exist then either. So I was just making up things that would be ludicrous and could never happen. And he would bounce from a game show to a movie, and we'd insert him in actual footage and things like that. It was all going to be great fun. The other main thing that Jim was after was to move into a new era of puppetry, and he decided that would be electronic puppetry. And he created some really, amazing looking electronic puppets, which are in the 10-minute test reel Inner Tube, which is available on YouTube. And they look great. And they play in a rock band. And so there was, music, and rock music was not so common back then on TV. So there are all sorts of, and then there was another thing. Both he and I loved a performance artist named Paul Zaloom, who played, Jim was based in New York, as was I, and we'd seen him perform separately and thought he was great and wanted to incorporate him into the show, which we did. Some people who saw it felt it seemed out of place. He was just sort of stuck in there, but, it was sort of a variety show. So we were cool with it.
The Paul Zaloom part, Paul Zaloom was, he went on to star in Beakman's World. I understand what people say it seems as though it was just sort of shoved in there, because it does seem like that, because it's only 10 minutes long and it does seem sort of out of place from the rest. But if it was a normal, say, like 20 minute episode and there was other things like that in it, then it wouldn't seem as out of place. So, I'll let it slide, David.
Thank you. Oh, phew. That is a load off my mind.
But that section where it does an environmental message, that, I mean, it's an important message to give across, but Did you write that, or was that
Paul's? No, that's all Paul.
Right.
Absolutely Paul. I mean, I may have tweaked it a little, made a few slight adjustments, but it was basically his thing. And, of course, the main thing about Paul was the way he used ordinary household items. And I must say, I did not refresh my memory by looking at this again, but I think he used toilet. There was pollution was represented by something, and I think there was snow or something, but he,
yeah.
Ingenious stuff. Do you remember?
I think it's sort of cotton wool that he takes out of the tubes,
yeah.
That represent factory
smokestacks.
Yeah, smokestacks.
Yeah.
Smokestacks. I can't speak. Yeah, I think it's cotton wool.
Smokestacks are delicious, though. Yeah. By the way, we should get some
smoky snacks. Yeah, they're lovely. Just to go back a little bit, you mentioned Muppets Take Manhattan. That is one of my favorites. Actually, it's one of my favorite Muppet movies. I'm a huge Muppet fan, by the way. I love the Muppets.
Oh, cool.
And that's one of my favourite films. It's the one I watched most as a kid. So for your contribution to that, thank you.
You're welcome. And if you like, later on, I can tell you a few things about it, but we'll stay on inner tube for the moment.
Okie doke. I don't know what to say now, because my next thing was going to be Paul Zaloom, but...
Well, maybe go to the thing after Paul Zaloom.
Well, I'll mention the music first, because we start off with the band. And I know you didn't write the music, but I really did actually quite enjoy that.
Yeah.
They play two tracks, and they're really quite catchy tunes. And it seemed like Jim Henson really didn't want to give up on this idea either, because he did another pitch reel called Lead Free TV, which became the Jim Henson Hour. And he even used, what is it? Is it Digit? One
yeah.
of the keyboardist. He used him again for the Jim Henson Hour. But used that, it had a different voice in that. I noticed, because I did actually do some research and watch some of the Jim Henson Hour, because we never had that. It never aired over here. The Storyteller aired, which was the second half of the Jim Henson Hour, but we never saw the other half. So I watched some of those, and I don't know, I think I maybe have appreciated InnerTube more. Yeah, no, I would have liked it more if it was more like InnerTube, because I do like the fact that they were trying to get away from the Muppets, trying to get away from. I mean, Kermit's in this, and Miss Piggy briefly, and I think the Miss Piggy segment's from something else, though. Is that right?
You mean on the Jim Henson Hour or on the InnerTube?
No, in InnerTube, Miss Piggy appears
Miss Piggy's
briefly.
Not there.
She's in a aerobics channel.
Let's face it. Exercise can be very boring, but if you do your daily dozen with someone you love, the time seems to just fly by.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Kermit introduces an aerobics channel, but I think it's a clip from something else.
Yeah, it could well be.
It cuts away quite quickly, and I read online that the reason it cuts away quickly is because Kermit enters the scene. In that. So that's
You know, Jim adjusted his basic idea. He was adamant about no Kermit. And by the end of our trying to sell InnerTube, he said, Kermit will be the host. But, you know, I get that totally. And I would have been happy with it. I love Kermit.
Yeah,
but nothing worked. And I think Bernie Brillstein's lack of enthusiasm is what killed it. In fact, I'm not even sure it went to the networks. I think it stopped with Bernie.
Right.
I can tell you a little story there. I don't know Bernie's thinking, but I do know that he cooperated with Jim's biographer, and Jim's biographer had some very pointed words about InnerTube. He criticized me. In the Jim Henson bio, he said that David Misch, I can't quote exactly, I just know one word exactly, which is that David Misch produced a very dark script. Now, you haven't seen the script, and I haven't seen it in 40 years or so, but I do know one thing. David Misch has never produced a dark script in his life. That's so ludicrous. I think that the biographer Andor Brillstein was just hung up on the idea that he was, quote, lost in this maze of channels, as if somehow that was inherently dark. I mean, Andy's having fun. The idea is he's bouncing around having a fun time in all these different channels. It wasn't supposed to be dark or haunted or, you know, depressing in some way. Just ludicrous. So it pissed me off. I don't mind being criticized for my actual faults, which I can give you a PDF of later. But to be criticized for writing a dark script when I didn't and no one thought it was is frustrating.
Yeah, that's not very nice. See, I think I got a couple of chapters into that biography and gave up.
Really? I couldn't tell, but it seemed to be written fine. What was your problem?
Well, actually, I was listening to the audiobook version.
Ah, okay.
And he does impressions of Kermit and things, and it's annoying.
Oh!
So I gave up.
That was a poor decision. And you know, Kermit is not the most difficult voice in the world to do, and I'll tell you a Muppet Steak Manhattan story about that later. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that the guy, I can't remember his name, Steve something, who took over for Jim,
couldn't quite get it.
Yeah, Steve Whitmire. He's brilliant, wonderfully talented guy, but he didn't sound exactly like Jim Henson doing Kermit. Who could? You know, it's very difficult.
Kermit was kind of like an extension of Jim Henson.
I mean,
even his voice sounded
very much so. Well, yeah. I'll tell you the story now, which is in Muppet State, Manhattan. Kermit loses his memory and takes a job with a Madison Avenue ad agency, becoming a mad frog. And he meets, I think, five or maybe six other frogs who are all working on an account, and they work it out together. But the fun thing is that all the other frogs talk exactly like him. And it's what it is all the puppeteers got a great kick out of Jim Henson's verbal idiosyncrasies, one of which was going, a lot, So these other frogs are constantly through the whole scene going, And it was, you know, a bit of an in-joke, but quite amusing.
Well, that was a great presentation you made this morning, Jill.
Well, thanks to Phil's flowchart.
Thank you, Jill. Hey, how about a new place for lunch today?
Was the Kermit part, was that not written for Kermit then? Because it doesn't it doesn't seem like Kermit.
Nope.
There's a couple of things he says in there that's very un-Kermit-like.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, and I don't have the memory to think maybe we were running out of time when Jim decided to throw Kermit in there, and there simply wasn't time for a rewrite.
Right. Because one of the things he says is,
about the inner tube system, our staff or personnel, please feel free to wonder what the answers are. And remember, with inner tube, if you're not plugged in, you can't get turned on.
Yes, that's not Kermit.
Yeah, that's not
but
Kermit.
But on the other hand, I feel it's funny.
So Crasher, the Muppet who either he's trying to escape and then he crashes through other people's channels.
He isn't trying to escape. Jim loves anarchy. That was Animal in the original Muppets.
Yeah.
And he loves characters who just try to break through everything and the tricksters.
I just mean because he does escape at one point, but then he goes back in. So my mistake. He does not try to escape. He's just trying to be anarchic and jump through other channels.
Exactly.
He reminds me of Vivian from The Young Ones.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, there are those trickster characters all over. I do comedy lectures on comedy, and I talk about the history of trickster. And because they're 99% men, he is always the anarchic figure who, as his name shows, is always trying to fool people and to upend the situation. All three Marx brothers were tricksters.
Yeah.
But they occur in comedy constantly because comedians are inherently tricksters.
Yeah, because Crasher's got this sort of punk look to him, and he looks a bit like Vivian to me. He even has like red hair, and he's got an English accent, so it just came across as...
Oh, interesting. I wonder if Jim was inspired by that.
Yeah, I wonder. Would Crasher still have been in the original script if...
Oh, yeah.
If John Candy was in it. So you would have someone, you would have two people going through, you know, crashing through into different channels. Was that still...
Well, I wrote the half hour and I don't remember Crasher doing that. Or if he did it in a way that would not interfere with Candy's arc.
Right. I just thought that it was maybe a thing that you added in for the, you know, the 10-minute version because you knew you weren't going to get Candy or you weren't going to get a guest. It was just something that... You know, just to, so someone else was jumping through channels to channels.
Yeah, that could be. I actually don't remember Crasher in the original script. You know what I should do? I'll make a note of this. Is maybe see if I have the original script and put it up on my website, davidmish.com.
Can you recall any skits that weren't used? Any ideas? Any...
The vast majority of the sketches weren't used. I really, you know, I should have done my homework. I did not. I didn't look at the script, much less the actual pilot. before this, but I do know that there were full-fledged skits in there. I do remember one thing that didn't make it, and it was very frustrating. So Jim Henson had two things. Mm-hmm. He had girlfriends in every city of the world, because mm-hmm. he flew all over the world, and he put them in their own apartments. He also had a wife. Yeah. His wife was named Jane, and she was an expert puppeteer who he met young. And I guess they had an arrangement that she didn't seem to have any problem with his lifestyle. And they were very affectionate towards each other. He respected her enormously. He respected her to the point where she has sort of had veto power over any idea. So we were in a pitch meeting about what became InnerTube. And he and I was pitching an idea about a soap opera parody. One of the bits in it was that Miss Piggy was going to be confronted with her evil identical twin triplets. Anyway, Jane said no. And she said the reason was that people would be freaked out to see two Miss Piggies on screen at the same time, because that would show that they weren't real. So that reasoning caused me a bit of consternation for a few reasons. First of all, she isn't real. Mm-hmm. Second of all, everyone knows that. But this was actually a Henson Company principle, to the point where I was invited to go into the Muppet workshop, which was off limits to any civilian. And I was a semi-civilian, since I wasn't really a Muppet employee. I was just working on individual projects, but they nonetheless allowed me in. And there I could see all the disembodied puppets, which, you know, if a kid saw, presumably the kid would melt into a pool of water. So I got why she felt that way, but I disagreed and said nothing. And that was that. By the way, quick note, the Muppet Workshop in New York was in Muppet Mansion, which was a townhouse on the Upper East Side of New York in a lovely neighborhood. It was very expensive, and it was four or five floors. And the highlight of it really was there was a mobile hanging from the center as if it were a chandelier. And it wasn't really Muppet themed. It was just gigantic, four-story high mobile, which you couldn't help but gawk at. Every floor was filled with craftspeople and technical people working on Muppet-related matter. And it was a wonderful place to go to work, though I only did for a relatively short time.
Go back to something that you said earlier about vetoing the whole Miss Piggy thing.
Yeah.
I kind of understand that reasoning, although if it was a soap opera, I would just, as a child, I would just think they hired someone else who looked like Miss Piggy to play Miss Piggy's twin.
A Miss Piggy lookalike, yes.
Yeah. So I don't really understand that reasoning as an adult. As a kid, I would have just accepted it. So,
okay. You know. Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
When we shot InnerTube, Jim asked me to come to the shoot, which took like a week or something. He asked me to sit right by his side, and he said, if they do anything with the dialogue that isn't what you want, you tell me. And after every scene, he would say, is that all right, David? I felt like I was a co-producer or something. I felt so honored that I was sitting by this incredibly talented, famous man, and he would not do anything unless I agreed to it. So it was a heady, wonderful experience. Then when the shooting stopped, my relationship with Jim totally ended.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he was mean or not, you know, or being bad to me. He just didn't have any more use for me. Mm-hmm. And what I gradually realized, because I saw him work with other people in a similar way, is that Jim regarded everyone as a craftsperson. You were hired because you were good with your hands and you could make puppets. You were hired because you were good with your voice and you could do the voice of a puppet. You could handle lights. You could handle sound equipment. Or in my case, you could handle words. But when the need for your skills had passed, your time had passed. He just moved on to the next craftsperson. So when he was done with me, it was on to the editor. And that's fine. It was discombobulating as a person to go from intimate to professional in one go.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking there that I watched a documentary that was on YouTube that originally aired on PBS in the 90s called The World of Jim Henson. And they actually show clips, they show a clip of InnerTube on there.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. I don't know. I was just watching it just for, you know, I fell down a sort of Jim Henson rabbit hole and started watching stuff on YouTube. Yeah, I want to talk Muppets Take Manhattan. I want to hear stories about Muppets Take Manhattan.
I got stories.
Because I can't really, I feel like I can't really judge Inner Tube because it's only 10 minutes long.
It's tough, I think.
Yeah, but it's...
The frustrating thing about that was that the script had a beginning and a middle and an end. Mm-hmm. It was, an actual show, whereas Inner Tube is just tiny little things showing what could be done if you give us the money to make a series. And I didn't think it was anywhere near as satisfying.
But I did enjoy it. I liked the music. I liked the characters. But I would like to have seen more. Muppets Take Manhattan. I love this film so much. So let's talk about this.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how I got into it. Mm-hmm. So I got a call from a friend of mine who is a producer. He usually produced for Woody Allen, but he was doing this as well. Mm-hmm. And he said Muppets, and I was not a Muppets fan. I was really not interested. I was far above that, much superior to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I dealt with adults and adult themes. I wanted to do sexy, outrageous stuff, and the Muppets were conventional.
Yeah, like Callahan.
And he said, well, look, I'm an idiot. Yeah, right. Okay, I'm an idiot. I'm not denying it. So I said no. And he said, well, David, actually, this is going to be a kind of special movie because Jimmy's Society wants to get a whole list of top guest stars. You know, they had guest stars in all the movies, but this was going to be incredible. He said Dustin Hoffman, at that time one of the biggest stars in the world, mm-hmm. had agreed to do it. And based on Hoffman doing it, they said they had Steve Martin, Michael Jackson, Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Laurence Olivier, and the list went on. And, when I pulled my jaw off the floor, I said, yes, 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 I desperately want to do it. Please, please, please. So I got the gig. So as I'm beginning to write these cameos, which was originally all I was supposed to do, just write the cameos, I ended up polishing the whole script. But he said, there's bad news. Dustin Hoffman was planning to do a parody of the famous producer Robert Evans, who produced Bob Evans, he's known as. He produced The Godfather and a number of other top movies for Paramount. Mm-hmm. And he had a very distinctive voice, which you can hear. There's a Bob Evans documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. Wonderful documentary. You learn a lot about filmmaking. But in any case, Hoffman decided that Evans would be offended. Hoffman did it at parties all the time. But he thought doing it on the big screen for the whole public would be embarrassing. And he was afraid Evans would take offense, so he wasn't going to do it. The instant he said that, everyone else dropped out of the movie. And we ended up, as you know from seeing the movie, with Brooke Shields,
yep.
Linda Lavin, Joan Rivers, Art Carney, all second or third string people. Not to say they weren't talented,
nope.
But they were not major movie stars. And the coda to that is that a few years later, there was a movie called Wag the Dog, mm-hmm. where Hoffman starred and did his Bob Evans impression for the entire movie. He played the entire part as Bob Evans. So what can you say?
Gregory Hines is in Muppets Take Manhattan, so that's good. I like Gregory Hines.
But all the people I mentioned are talented.
No, they're really
not.
Good.
They're not Steve Martin and Michael Jackson.
Steve Martin was in the original Muppet movie as well, so you think he would come back?
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was sort of a drop in guest stars, really, Muppets Take Manhattan, considering Orson Welles and Steve Martin and Mel Brooks were all in the Muppet movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, in the Muppet movie,
Muppet movie, yeah. And then you've got Gregory Hines and Joan Rivers and Muppets Take Manhattan.
Yeah.
I still love it.
Yep. So that was the movie was directed, of course, by Frank Oz, and Frank and I worked very closely together on the script, which had been written by two other people, but Frank wanted to actually, again, he just hired me to do the cameos, and then we ended up tweaking other things, but nothing major, and I didn't get credit on the movie. Frank very, very generously and totally illegally gave me a fake credit at the end of the movie, special consultant. And I appreciated that. But the Writers Guild turned me down. Anyway, Frank was a great guy. His main line, which he used to soften people up when he met them, is, I've spent half my life with my hand up a pig's ass. Which, of course, was true.
Yep.
So Frank and I had slightly differing versions of visions of what the movie was supposed to be. And his vision, of course, would win. He was the director. He wanted it to be warm. He felt the first Muppet movie was a little too wacky. Mm. I love wacky, and I kind of hate warm. So I kept trying to get the whack in there as much as possible, and Frank kept telling me, nope. and we rewrote scenes. I rewrote, I'll talk more about it later, but there's a scene in a hospital. I think I rewrote that 12 times. Right. Anyway, the whole point was to keep the comedy in check, not to eliminate comedy, but to make it sweet and lovable and warm. As an example of one of my gags that got cut was, I always love this, Kermit goes up to the top of the Empire State Building and looks out over the city in his moment of crisis, two-thirds of the way through. And I had two things there. First of all, he has this heartfelt thing, you know, I swear I'm not giving up, I'm going to make it. And he then goes, yells out, you hear that, New York? I'm going to make it no matter what. I'm going to make it. And a soft voice comes back from far away. Hey, we're trying to sleep. So I like that. And then when he gets off, he takes the elevator down. And when he gets off the elevator, he's just miserable and doesn't even notice his two giant ape legs walk into the elevator. So I appreciated the King Kong.
Right. It took my second there, but yeah, I got it.
So let's see. The other thing is the Central Park scene, which you mentioned Gregory Hines. Mm-hmm. That was his scene. And that was such a wonderful day. It was outdoors in Central Park. The New York City cooperated. I remember when we shot the Joan Rivers scene, it was 100 degrees. But when we shot Gregory Hines, it was probably in the 70s. It was so lovely. We got there at 6 in the morning and spent the whole day. And naturally, when you have Frank Oz and Jim Henson as Kermit and Piggy doing their thing in the middle of Central Park, a crowd gathered. It wasn't an overwhelming crowd, but it was about 100 people. And what was so delightful was as they watched Jim and Frank working, I was looking at their eye lines, and all of them were looking up. Mm-hmm. They were looking at the puppets, even though these two giant men, both of them were 6'2 or 6'3, were standing there, and they were the actual people who were operating these pieces of felt. Mm-hmm. But nobody looked at them. The force of their personality into these puppets was so strong. People were just transfixed by the puppets. And by the way, the puppets did not act as they always do, because between takes, Frank and Jim would joke around, often with dirty jokes. And they always stayed in character. So it was Kermit and Piggy making dirty jokes. And the crowd was just on the ground with hilarity, as was I.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. That sounds amazing. But I was a child. There's a picture of you, I posted it on my blog a few weeks ago, the Callahan interview, of you in a hospital with Kermit. And obviously that's after Kermit gets hit by a car, which is the most traumatizing thing a child has ever watched, ever.
Well, there's also Bambi's mother being killed, but I'll get it too.
I was at the age where that Kermit getting hit by a car was more, I didn't really see Bambi till I was older, so.
Okay.
So any stories behind that picture?
Well, not behind the picture per se, but mm-hmm. certainly behind that scene. So that scene, it was also 100 degrees, and there was no air conditioning. We were in the second floor of a hospital where the hospital was still working, but the second floor had been abandoned for some reason. So we were able to shoot there with no trouble, but they didn't air condition it because nobody was supposed to be there. So the sweat was just pouring off all of us. It was very uncomfortable. Jim Henson was underneath a bed because Kermit was lying in bed. So he lay underneath the bed with his arm sticking up painfully, painfully over the course of hours, manipulating Kermit. So Jim, you know, when he emerged, he looked like he'd just been in the pool because he was sweating so profusely. The other thing there is that the scene with the doctor that I rewrote 12 times. It was originally for Lily Tomlin. And I recall Lily was one of the last people to cancel. So I had arduously worked out 6 or 7 different characters for that actress to play in that scene. And we ended up getting Linda Lavin. Now, let me say, since that day, I wasn't really so familiar with Linda. I knew the sitcom Alice and It and She seemed ordinary. Since then, I've seen her on stage in theater productions, and this is one brilliant actress. Linda Lavin cannot be beat. But as she pointed out, I'm not Lily Tomlin. I cannot do many different characters. Word came to us before the scene shot. So I quickly had to put together another version of that scene and try to make it funny, even though there was a lot of exposition and the idea of the quick change characters had now been lost. So I finally put it together, and it was co-written by my wife, who's a doctor, and provided all the medical lingo in that scene, none of which Linda could remember. And so we put it on a piece of paper above Kermit's head, just out of camera range, and she did great with it. But the other thing was that I was taking my position as the engaged professional writer just off to the side, out of camera range, crouching on my knee with my legal pad, taking furious notes to do what I could to improve the scene. And after the first take, the camera person called Jim over to the video monitor where you could see the scene that you just shot and said, "We have a problem." And they looked at it, and Jim didn't see anything, and I didn't see any problem. I'm sorry, it was Frank Oz. Mm. Frank didn't see anything, and I didn't see anything. But then the camera person said, "Look in the picture frame." There was a picture above Kermit's head. And he said, "Look in the frame. What do you see there?" And there was me. It perfectly reflected me sitting, kneeling by the side of the thing. And I thought that this really improves the scene. But for some reason, they felt I had to move. And then the other big memory from that is something which Frank and Jim considered very historic, but has not gotten much play. I don't even think of the time. It was the largest gathering of Muppets in history.
Yeah.
And it was the wedding scene. Mm-hmm. There were, I think, 50 or 60 puppeteers underneath this giant floor, all of them sticking their hands up through the wood. And the whole stage is raised, and then the camera's raised to shoot it. And they had to make more Muppet characters, and it was a huge deal. Muppet puppeteers who hadn't worked for a while were called in, and they flew in from all over the world. And it was a real occasion. It was Kermit and Piggy's wedding. And Jim had a strong feeling of wanting to make things real. Maybe he got it from his wife, Jane, and the identical twin triplets. He felt that this wedding, to be important, had to be a real wedding. And of course, the question then becomes, wait a minute, how can you have a real wedding with two participants who don't exist? And the answer was to have a minister. So the minister in the movie is a real minister hired to actually marry Kermit and Piggy.
So it's legal then.
Yes.
Piggy, I thought Gonzo was going to play the minister.
Which makes their subsequent breakup even more heartbreaking.
Yeah.
By the way, the Muppet Babies was Jim's idea, and he just thought it would be a great commercial thing and a cute thing, too. I was opposed to it. I said, "It just stops the movie. Nothing happens." And Frank and Jim looked at me, as was appropriate. It's like, "You idiot. this will be fun, and B, this will make us millions of dollars," both of which turned out to be true.
Yeah. And the grand scheme of things, it makes sense because it became a cartoon series and went on for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And it gave Frank Welker a lot of work, which I'm always happy for because I love Frank Welker. But yeah, if you watch the film, that scene doesn't really belong there. Could quite easily be cut out. It's the same with the Muppets Family Christmas. Well, actually, it makes more sense in Muppets Family Christmas because they're watching home videos of them as kids, so that makes more sense. But in Muppets Day in Manhattan, it always sort of slowed the film down for me because I was an idiot child, and at that time, I didn't know Muppet Babies existed because I hadn't seen
yet. That provides me with vindication. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. So I mentioned this to you before, but it was in the lost recording that we did the first time. But apparently you were a big part of my childhood then, because you were in Mork and Mindy. Well, you wrote Mork and Mindy, rather, some of them. And Duckman in my teens, and then Muppets Take Manhattan. So
I've kind of plotted my career to follow your growing
That's
up.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. And you know what, David? It's a little bit creepy. I would just like to stop.
Well, point taken. I will not do it again. I will not plot my career to follow your adolescence anymore.
That's good. Thank you very much. That's a relief. I'm not a big musical fan, but I love Little Shop of Horrors. So
I think it's really not given enough credit.
No.
I think the first half of Little Shop is as perfect a musical movie as you can make. And the second half is really, really good. It just, to me, that first half is an apotheosis. It's just really the most beautiful thing. Just dynamic and fascinating.
I think it is really well made, that movie. It is, from the puppeteering and everything, it's just really bloody well done. But yeah, so there's another thing. You're part of my childhood there, David.
And my one story there is at the ending, because I was hired, and actually Frank paid for my honeymoon. We came to London, and I put together an ending. The idea was that, just like in the movie, the plant kills everyone and takes over the world. And my job was to simply write ways in which the plant destroys the world, amusing visual gags. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and it was produced. And on the anniversary reissue of the DVD, it's included the original footage. So Frank put together the movie and had a preview. And he told me, and he said this publicly too, that the audience just seemed to love it until the ending where everyone dies, at which point they not only didn't love it anymore, they hated it. He said the preview cards that people filled out were the worst he'd ever seen in the history of show business. How dare you kill the lovers and things like that. So that was that. And he, as far as I know, put together the actual ending, which is like 30 seconds long, himself. And it's wonderful. I think it works totally. I would have liked to have my ending there, but the audience hated it. So that's that. And I think it works great the way it is now.
I do think that the one where Audrey 2 and, you know, destroys the world is amazing. I just think it's brilliant to watch. I have it in Blu-ray. I'm holding it in my hand right now. It's credited as the director's cut, and it has that ending on it. So
yeah,
it should really probably be the David Mish cut. I think Warner Brothers should should change that there.
It's definitely a catchier name.
Yeah. but yeah, so you can find Inner Tube on YouTube, and it's I think I typed in Inner Tube 1987 and I found it. But you can also find it, as David said, on his website, David Mish. You can find a link to it there, davidmish.com, and I'll link to it in my blog, dropthepilot.blogspot.co.uk. I need to get a personalized URL for that, because that's far too long. So that's all we have time for. I'd like to thank David again for joining me. This has been a pleasure listening
Likewise.
To your stories. You can follow the show on Facebook or Twitter at Drop the Pilot Pod. Email me, please. I'm using dropthepilotpod@gmail.com if you have any comments or suggestions or what have you. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Goodbye.